Hello and welcome to The Thriller Zone. I'm your host, David Temple, here in Season 3. Welcome aboard. As you can see, the booth to the studio is open, which means work is done. On today's show, I am thrilled to welcome a guy that I've been following from a distance for some time. His name is Brian Freeman, and his book is The Bourne Sacrifice. Are you a Robert Ludlum fan? Well, then you're going to love this book. As you hear me talking with Brian here shortly, this book is going to be in my top 10 summer reads of this summer. I'll go into greater detail inside the show, but it is a doozy. As you're going to find out, I don't know how many times I've seen the Bourne movies time and time and time again, but classics like that just never get tired. Anyway, without any further ado, Brian is in the green room, so let's get busy. Welcome to the Thriller Zone, Mr. Brian Freeman.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
This is an exciting time. By the way, let me throw this in here. We're going to get to Bourne Sacrifice very shortly. I have many things to say about it.
I'm just happy to see the book. I don't even have my own copies yet, so I'm excited to see it. I've been seeing that cover for a few months now, and I love it. So
you don't have a copy?
I don't have a copy myself. No, I've got the first two here, but no, I don't have my own copy of Sacrifice yet.
Wow, I don't know whether to feel badly or better that I beat you on something, but.
That's okay. I did have kind of a sneak preview when I wrote it. So
nice little thing they do for your book. They put your initials right in the middle. Did you know that?
I've seen that. Yeah, that's really cool. I love it. It's funny. Every now and then publishers do really interesting things on the inner jacket. A lot of times I don't actually notice it until someone tells me about it because I typically don't remove the jacket. So.
Oh, yeah. I'm one of those freaks that loves... I love the covers. I love the, you know, I spend a lot of time looking at who designs them and so forth. And we've got a couple of, there's one that, if I can just go off on a tangent here, looking at some of your books, we're going to talk about Bourne Sacrifice, of course, but there's one that you're getting ready to release in August called
I Remember You.
Yeah. I love that cover. That is so cool.
Isn't that great? Yeah. Let me. I'll one second. I'll show it to you here.
Oh, good. See, I love show and tell.
Yeah, exactly. There we go. See, now I remember you. So, yeah, see, isn't that a cool cover? That's really, really striking.
The way the city just drips. And I got to admit, Brian, and again, this is all about Bourne Sacrifice, but then again, it's all about you. So, but I was, you know, doing a little follow-up on your website, and I went to your Amazon page and started reading I Remember You, and holy crap, it grabs you right out of the start.
That was a fun, twisty one to write, I'll tell you. When you kill off someone in the first chapter and then bring her back to life, I always figure that's a good start. So.
Yeah, I'm not sure I've actually seen that happen before, but I know it's a little bit preemptive, but man, if you want to come back around and talk about that book, I'd have to read it first, but yeah, we can certainly talk about it.
There we go.
All right, I've completely forgotten where I was going down a couple of different rabbit holes. I know what it was. Every photograph I have seen of you, you're standing somewhere in the cold. Now, either I know you live in Minnesota, right?
Right. Yep.
Is it truly winter all year round?
Well, you know, there's a couple weeks in July that are not bad. Yeah, so. We're actually in the midst of them right now. It's going to be 90 degrees today. So it does warm up occasionally.
Yeah. Yeah. Wife and I went out to, Minneapolis recently, first time I'd ever been there. What a lovely city.
Mm-hmm. Yep, absolutely.
I don't know what I was expecting, but it was lovely. Anyway, all right.
But now, yeah, the story behind my author photograph with I think it's got the red flannel shirt on. It was actually about 2 degrees when I did that photo shoot. And well, I was trying not to let my teeth chatter while they were taking pictures, and I promptly went home and then threw out my back because my muscles were so cold. So.
That's amazing. Well,
you got to suffer for your art, you know?
Yeah. Well, that's what it's called. Now, as a bit of background, a lot of times I will find, you know, of course, authors, who were writing about military thrillers served in the, you know, in the armed forces, and or they, if it's a cop book, they were a detective at one time. And so I always like to find out, okay, what's Brian's story? And the only thing I could find is that you were director of marketing and PR for an international law firm called Fagren Benson, I'm thinking.
Right. And yeah, no, I'm a storyteller, but I don't have those specific experiences in the military or the police. And you know, I mean, obviously I do research on such things. And the nice thing is the more books you write, the more you have readers that show up with particular expertise in various areas that are very happy and generous about sharing their wisdom. So that helps a lot. But you know, my focus is on the storytelling side. In fact, I always tell aspiring writers, you know, who are, they kind of tell me, oh, I'm going to go off and do the FBI training course or this or that. And I said, well, you know, that's great. And, you know, that's terrific to do that kind of stuff. But just remember, you know, and at the end of the day, your job is not, you know, to be a policeman. Your job is not to be a, you know, a Navy SEAL or an FBI special agent. You are a storyteller. And that's what the reader's looking for.
You know, and that's an awesome thing for you to say, and I appreciate the fact. I mean, having now sold, 46 countries, 22 languages, almost two dozen books, you have, you give the illusion, as any good storyteller would, is that you were there. And you're kind of reiterating something that I had a conversation with someone recently, and that is, you know, our gift, our talent is storytelling. We don't have to have studied all those things if you're a right. good researcher. Now,
right.
If you're going to write a military thriller and you you pull a bonehead move with the caliber of a gun, your readers are going to go, David, really?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, that's exactly right. And there are certain areas that, you know, honestly, it helps an awful lot to have specific background. I mean, if you're talking about an area of the genre where there's really, you know, detailed knowledge necessary, and that might be true of, you know, medical thrillers or legal thrillers as well. You're certainly skating a fine line there if you're coming from the outside. So, but you know, I don't write military thrillers, and we've got a lot of great, you know, great writers out there who do. So I figure, well, and I wish them well. So.
Yeah, and I would say, would you call your thriller pretty much all psychological thrillers, right?
My own thrillers, yeah, I would say they're pretty much psychological thrillers, exactly.
And let's do this just for shits and giggles. If you were telling this to someone who did not know, who is not wrapped up in the writing world, how would you describe? Okay, Billy, a psychological thriller is.
Yeah, it's a story that's still going to be propelling you through the narrative, forcing you to turn the pages. Getting you to stay up until 3 a.m. to find out what happens next. But by the time you get to that last twist, you're also so deep inside the heads of the characters that you're sharing the whole experience with them, whether it's the hero, whether it's the villain, you're that much in sync with the emotions of the characters that they really become a part of your life.
Excellent. And, you know, going back to this director of marketing PR, what I wanted to ask, what was that like? And more specifically, what did you learn that has helped your writing career from that job?
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, first of all, my favorite story about being a director of marketing at a law firm. I remember I was going home on the bus one day and I was chatting with this woman and she said, oh, so, you know, what do you do? And I said, oh, I work at Fagren Benson. It's a law firm downtown. And she looked at me rather suspiciously and said, oh, so you're a lawyer. And I just laughed and said, no, it's even worse. I do public relations for lawyers. She did not laugh. She looked at me dead serious and said, you're right. That is worse.
Wow.
So, I think it was right around that time I really started kind of getting serious about, you know, getting words on the page and getting that book written. So, but you know, the reality is it was a great place to work. It was a great team of people, and I learned a lot about storytelling working at a law firm. And the fact of the matter is I talked to a lot of litigators there, and the litigators were very open about the fact that when it comes to jury trials, the lawyer who's the best storyteller wins. You tell the best story, that's what the jury's going to respond to. And so I learned a lot from them about, you know, kind of their storytelling craft.
I never thought about that. I just watched the new episode or the series Lincoln Lawyer, which I think it was on. Yeah. And I was just pulled into his storytelling, and I never really thought, I always thought it was the power of persuasion more than storytelling, in that if you can, more along the lines of a good salesman, and I don't mean that in a bad way, but it feels kind of like that, doesn't it?
A little bit. And yet the fact is, particularly, in litigation, so many of the areas of litigation are very, very technical. There's a lot of detail that goes into it. It's really easy to sort of lose a jury in the details and technical minutiae. And the litigators would always say, you have to cut through that. You need to be able to connect with them on an emotional basis and make the story resonate for them as people. And ultimately, that's what I'm trying to do in my thrillers as well.
Yeah. Well, mission accomplished. I'm going to make a little play here because I do. I serve both YouTube channel and my podcast, which is audio only. So I'm going to do some things here visually so that people can really appreciate a lot of your body of work. But you got almost two dozen books here. So we got Jonathan Stride series, yep. The Frost Easton series, Cab Bolton series, five standalones, and now three Jason Bourne books. First of all, Golf Clap. Second of all, at 29 years old, how have you been able to manage to write so many books?
Oh, you're so kind. You're so kind. it's when I think back to the beginnings of my, Jonathan Stride series, which those were the first five books that I did. The first Stride novel, I think, came out when I was, 42, 43. And I will say Stride has pulled off a pretty amazing trick, because when I started writing the Stride series, Stride was older than me. And now here we are almost 20 years later, and I'm quite a bit older than Stride. So that's a nice trick he's pulled off. I wish I knew how he did that.
Yeah. And I know this question is much akin to, asking who's your favorite child, but do you have a favorite series and or character in your repertoire? And this could be inside the Bourne world or outside, but I'm just curious.
Yeah, that's a really good question. I've heard that from readers for years. What's your favorite book? Who's your favorite character? And I always really struggled with that for exactly that, issue, that it is kind of like trying to pick your favorite child. But honestly, I've written, there are two books that I've written in the past few years, The Deep, Deep Snow and The Ursulina, which are technically both standalones and yet also fit together hand in glove, to the extent that I almost think of them as one long novel, one long project. The Deep, Deep Snow was a finalist for the Edgar Award. The Ursulina just came out in hardcover and ebook this year. It was an audio original last year for Audible. And they're both written in first person in a female narrative voice, two different female narrators in the book. I always say that The Deep, Deep Snow is the story of a daughter and The Ursulina is the story of a mother. And those two books, two very, very different kinds of stories, and yet they just go to my heart in a way that it just, there's something special about those books for me. And I look back on those novels and I think, yeah, those books are the reason that I do what I do. So those ones are my favorite right now. Now, who knows, next book I write, I may say, nope, that's my favorite. Cause for every year it felt like the next book I wrote, that would be my favorite, cause I was so close to the story. But The Deep, Deep Snow and The Ursulina, I love those two books, and they're a great way to discover my approach to storytelling too.
Okay, you just anticipated my next question, because that's really kind of why I brought it up, because everybody has, they got a secret favorite of theirs. And what I like to do is, I know that if you have a favorite in your repertoire, then I want to know what that is, because I'm probably going to go straight to that and go, I'm going to read his very best work, as though I only had time to read one of your books, because having now read Bourne Sacrifice and not having read your other Bournes, I don't want to jump it because I got enough stuff to say about that, but I'm like, I got to read, and this is no hyperbole, I have to read more of your work now. So there.
Yeah, and that's one of the advantages of having done a number of standalones over the past several years. Now, it gives readers a good opportunity to kind of dive in and you know, experience my work. What's been fun for me over the last few years is just the sheer diversity of stories and characters I've been able to work on. I mean, you know, on one hand, I can be writing one of my, you know, Stride novels, more police procedural, or I can be writing these very intense emotional thrillers like The Deep, Deep Snow and The Ursulina. And I can put that down and pick up, you know, the action-driven, adrenaline-focused Bourne novels. It's just been a lot of fun being able to explore all those different sides of storytelling. And I've really enjoyed that.
So I'm trying to figure out the numbers here. Are you working on, I'm going to guess you're working on probably two books a year, right?
It's been three the last several years. Yeah.
Holy moly. Now,
you know, I confess this year, I think I'm on track to only quote unquote do two. I feel like I'm slacking off a bit, but the last few years it was three a year for, I think, the last three or four years.
That is no easy feat. Now, I've talked to people who are, you know, I'm one book a year, period. Then I'm talking to folks who are doing two and three and sometimes four. And I'm like, all right, well, you know what it is? It comes down to discipline. I have to think, having written some books myself, if you have the discipline to set aside the time and plan accordingly, you can do it, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's really about knowing your own schedule and what you can accomplish and what you need to do to stay on deadline. There's no way that I could have been doing this back, you know, in the early years of my writing career. I mean, I was just, you know, building a familiarity with my craft and it's because I've been, you know, doing this for almost 20 years and I've you know, produced almost 2,000 books that I've got a comfort level now that lets me do it. But it's still hard. It's just crazy some days.
And I've read two blurbs that came across my desk in the last few weeks, and it's having to tell kind of the two masters of the craft. I mean, Michael Conley said, he called one of your books a page-turner of the highest caliber. I got deep respect for Michael Conley. I mean, the guy is prolific, so there's that one. The second one that blew my mind was to have Nelson DeMille tell you, you know, call you a first-rate storyteller. I mean,
I gotta tell you a good Nelson DeMille story here. I got an email from a reader a few months ago, retired police officer, and happened to be a retired police officer from the town where Nelson lives. And he said, you know, I've been meaning to tell you this story for years as to how I got into your books. And he said, years and years ago, he and his partner got called on a call to Nelson DeMille's house because an alarm had gone off at the house. And he said, protocol is when an alarm goes off, you have to, you know, go inside and check the property, make sure everything's secure. So they were inside Nelson DeMille's house, checking to make sure everything was okay. And they were in DeMille's bedroom. And there on his nightstand, he had a copy of my first book, Immoral. And the police officer said, you know, I figured if it was good enough for Nelson, then it was good enough for me. So he went out, bought a copy of Immoral. He read it, loved it, had been a fan all these years ever since. So that's one of the best stories I've ever heard.
Oh my God, dude, you can't top that.
Yeah.
Man. All right. Let's get to this puppy dog. All right. Brian, if you know anything, if you listen to the show at all, you know, I do a whole lot of reading and, I don't, no one has called me. Is hyperbolic a word? I know if you are a person of hyperbole, would you be hyperbolic?
I think you would, yes.
No, okay. So I don't want to be hyperbolic, but this book, two words, holy crap. This is one of those books that I loved it. And while reading it, it was, and I can't say this about every book of this caliber. I felt like I was watching Matt Damon in a Bourne movie.
Interesting.
Maybe it's because I am a hardcore Jason Bourne fan and have watched all of the movies, or what, four of them now, right? So many times it's kind of embarrassing. I don't know why. To me, he's like an everyday James Bond, right? And this book delivers just that kind of a thrill. Matter of fact, Here's my almost like I'm doing a review. Action scenes, intense and believable, characters, multidimensional, and I literally didn't want the book to end. A lot of books, because I'm on a time limit and I'm preparing for shows, I'm like, geez, could this just get going? It's, you know, it's 600 pages now, but I didn't want this to end. So I'm putting this on my top 10 summer 22 reads.
Well, I really appreciate that. And I think you put your finger on a couple things that are really important to me with the Bourne novels. One is that there have been so many iterations of Jason Bourne over the years. I mean, you figure Ludlum wrote The Bourne Identity all the way back in 1980. So, you know, here we are, you know, 42 years later. And I got to tell you, I read The Bourne Identity all the way back in 1980 when I was, 17 years old. And if you had told me that, you know, 40 years later, books would be coming out with my name and Ludlum's name on the cover, I would have said, oh, that's just crazy. So, you know, you had three Ludlum Bourne novels. You had, I think, 10 or 11 Eric von Lustbader Bourne novels. You've got all of the Matt Damon movies. And I may be one of the few people who remember that before Matt Damon was Jason Bourne, Richard Chamberlain was actually Jason Bourne in an NBC miniseries with Jacqueline Smith as Marie St. Jacques. I've got my Bourne cred here, but that's one of the things that I think creates a challenge, because you have a lot of people that have very different ideas of who Bourne is. And what I wanted to do was create a version of Bourne that would be very, very authentic to Ludlum's original vision and put him in the modern era and create all new plots and characters around him, and yet do it in a way that people that have different visions of Bourne, like the Matt Damon version, would still feel like they're like dropped down into the middle of that series, and they can very readily picture, if they want to picture Matt Damon as Bourne, it flows naturally into the story. The other thing is, you mentioned the dimensions of the characters, and one of the things that was sort of interesting for me is, I mean, you talked about the fact that I write, you know, very psychological thrillers. They're very inside the heads of the characters, which, you know, some readers may go, well, you know, why do they have this psychological thriller guy writing, you know, the action adrenaline driven Bourne series? But I think what makes Bourne so distinctive as a hero is he's fractured psychologically. You know, he's lost his memory. He's struggling with this very fundamental sense of who is he as a man, and what's the nature of his morality. That's right inside my wheelhouse. And that's what I really enjoy working with the Bourne character, is exploring that sort of ongoing struggle he has of the kind of man he truly is.
Well, it, you know, to say the phrase page turner seems nearly cliche, but there is a chase scene. I don't remember exactly where it is. I meant to put a marker in it, but boy, you're nearing the end of the book, and there's a chase scene that just, if your palms aren't sweating, I don't think your heart is beating. That's all I'm going to say. But I want to drill down on this idea of being welcomed into the Ludlum legacy. And, you know, when you were approached, do you recall what it is you thought and maybe what you were asked at the time? I don't know. How far would that have been back?
Yeah, that would have been coming up on 4 years now. I got a call from my agent to let me know that Putnam had taken over the Bourne series with the estate, and they were looking for a new author to kind of reboot the series. And was I interested in tossing my hat into the ring?
Jeez.
And I've been a Ludlum fan my whole life, and a huge Bourne fan. And I said, yeah, let's give it a try. And I think it was probably 4 months of radio silence went by, and, you know, didn't hear a word. And I just assumed they'd decided to go another way, which is fine. I'm sure there were lots of authors that were interested in the opportunity. And then my agent called back and said 5 words that will live in my memory for a long time. Putnam wants you for Bourne. So I called Tom Colgan over at Putnam and kind of talked about, you know, my vision for how I would approach Bourne. And, you know, very much the way I was talking about the idea that I really wanted to go back to Ludlum's original character without being tied down to everything that had been done with Bourne in the past. Because if you look back at Ludlum's books, you're in the Watergate and Vietnam era. And if you look at the Matt Damon movies, they've kind of taken them in a whole different direction, which was what Eric did in his books as well. I said, you know, I just think we need to start over, sort of reboot the series from the ground up, but keep the Bourne character very true to life for Ludlum fans and for Matt Damon fans. You know, Tom loved that idea, and I kind of mapped out how I wanted to approach it in you know the first of my Bourne books, which is the Bourne Evolution, and I did a few sample chapters, and he ran all that by the estate, and. They loved the direction that I wanted to take the character, and we were off to the races. And you know, and one of the things that I really feel great about is that when the Bourne Evolution was done and Tom passed it along to the estate, they came back and said, you know, we don't want to change a word. So that's exactly what you want to hear because and you know, with the Bourne Sacrifice, Publishers Weekly was saying, you know, Freeman is a worthy successor to Ludlum. Well, you know, there are a few compliments that are nicer for a thriller writer than something like that.
Yeah, that's pretty stunning. And I just got to meet Tom Colgan at Thriller Fest a few weeks back, and a delightful guy. And talking about the guy that sits on top of the mountain with, I don't know how he does it. He's got so many different franchises that he's working on, and he's so monster talented, and he must just spend his entire day reading. I mean, yeah. Anyway. So. Such a fantastic book. I don't know if this is a kooky question but it's like, as writing as Ludlum, for lack of a better term, how do you feel like that differs? And I want this is aimed primarily for my writing listeners. Is there a different, how do you approach it differently from, say, Jonathan Stride, you know, as far as method and so forth?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. Yeah, I mean, Ludlum had such a very distinctive prose style. It was a very dramatic, very propulsive kind of prose style. It kind of had a breathless quality to it. And I think that because it was so distinctive, if you try to imitate the Ludlum style, it winds up feeling more like a caricature. And yet at the same time, if I just completely right in my own style, I think it feels, you know, just like a Brian Freeman book and not like, you know, a Robert Ludlum Brian Freeman book. So I have kind of a hybrid that's a little Ludlum and a little me. And I'm thinking through the prose in such a way that I'm just trying to let, you know, echoes of Ludlum kind of, you know, come through my style. And so I think what you get is something that's not exactly him, not exactly me, but this new combined entity that has qualities of that Ludlum propulsive style, and yet also has the sort of you know psychological depth of the characters that I like to bring to my books as well. And so, you know, in the beginning I didn't know, was that going to work? But I've been thrilled from, you know, to hear from so many readers that have really loved, you know, what has come out of that, and hopefully it feels like a Ludlum novel, even though the style is just not, you know, pure Ludlum. Because again, if you tried to do that, I think it would end up feeling false.
Yeah, and speaking of your readers, do you ever sit? This I find this so curious for a number of different reasons. Do you ever read your reviews?
You know, I learned all the way back in 2005 with my first book, Immoral, that it is psychologically a very unhealthy thing to read your reviews, because, you know, I mean, you can get, you know, 200 people, you know, putting out 5-star reviews and loving the book, and there's one person that hates it, and, you know, which one do you think you're going to focus on as a human being?
Yeah, the one that hates it.
Yeah, it's of course, exactly. You know, and you know, I think every writer wants every reader to be, you know, totally happy and loving the book. And, you know, the fact is, the reason we have so many different authors and genres and different approaches to storytelling is because we have so many different readers who are interested in different things and are looking for different things in their novels. So there's always going to be folks that will read and go, nah, that's just not for me. Well, that's perfectly fine. But it means that, you know, I typically steer clear of that. And if there's a great review out there that I should probably see, you know, my wife will see it and kind of screen it for me and say, yeah, take a look at this one. So.
Yeah, I don't know what that is about our psyche, and you being a psychological thriller expert, you should be able to, I should practically call you Dr. Friedman as I get on your couch, but I wonder why we do that. Is it that we're so hungry for the accolade, or we're going to focus on that one thing, that one pebble in our shoe that we can't seem to shake? I mean, I just find that so curious.
I know it is a strange part of human nature, but it is. I've talked to enough writers and enough artists in other media that have exactly the same experience, that I think it's just a pretty common problem for creative types. And I think most writers tend to be sort of neurotic creatures at heart. And I always tell aspiring writers that, you know, the biggest challenge you are going to face is not from editors or agents or publishers or readers. The challenge is going to come from inside you, because a writer is always his own worst enemy. And you have to kind of stare down that internal voice that says, well, yeah, you may have written, you know, two dozen novels, but this time, you know, you're just not going to be able to do it. And you need to be able to kind of, you know, stare that part of yourself down and realize, you know what, you can make this happen.
I've got a question. I noticed that Born Here, for instance, is through Putnam. Yep. But I could have sworn, am I right in this, that your standalone thriller that we're coming up in August, again, to give you an extra plug on that, is that, I want to say that's Thomas Mercer, isn't it?
Yeah, I've got relationships with four different publishers, which is, it's kind of fun because they all have different ways of approaching their audiences and they're looking for different stories. So a number of my standalones have come out through Thomas and Mercer. Obviously Putnam's doing the Bourne novels. My Jonathan Stride novels are being published by Blackstone. And they're also doing the print editions of my Audible originals. I also have a relationship with Audible. So the Deep, Deep Snow and the Ursulina, those came out as Audible originals. And now Blackstone has taken over the print and e-editions of those.
Okay, couple questions here. And the reason I ask this is because, again, so many of my listeners are up-and-coming writers such as myself, and we wonder, is that pretty standard operating procedure to have multiple publishing houses move variety books?
I think it's becoming a little bit more common. It was not particularly common, you know, when I started doing this. But I really felt it was good from a creative standpoint and good from a marketing standpoint. I mean, I think the days when, you know, an author would stick with one publisher for his entire career and put out a book a year and you know, there you go. That really has not been a workable model for a while now in the publishing industry. And so I felt that, you know, so many publishers have, you know, waves of you know, success that, you know, if that having multiple relationships from a marketing standpoint was a more secure way to approach the industry. So that if one publisher starts to have issues, you haven't got all your eggs in one basket. You also have other relationships that can kind of take up the slack.
That's the best phrase right there. Not all your eggs in one basket. And I hadn't thought about that, but you really are in the best possible position because you're diversifying risk.
Right. Exactly right. That is exactly right. So I'm going to take 5 seconds and do something really important. I'm going to release the cat from my office.
Go right ahead. Okay, this is a good time to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll hear about Brian Freeman's secret sauce. Stay with us. Your host, David Temple here. Hey, before we get back to the show, I thought I would throw in this one quick note. I have had authors approach me who want to actually advertise on the show, and I'm like, that's cool. I love that idea. I mean, think about it. We feature the best thriller writers in the world. You're one of the new up-and-coming thriller writers in the world to be, and you have a book coming out. Our rates are super reasonable. We're easy to work with, as you know, and we all want to work together to make success for all of us. Just reach out to us here at The Thriller Zone at thethrillerzone@gmail.com. Let's talk rates. Let's talk details. Let's do something together in the new year. I think you'll like it. Now, back to the show.
Hey there, I'm Brian Freeman, author of The Bourne Sacrifice, and I'm hanging out with David Temple in the Thriller Zone.
Your favorite authors, The Thriller Zone.
And now, back to the show.
For fear of sounding like Captain Obvious, I read somewhere that you're known for those You Are There settings. Sure. Again, back to describing to someone who may not be familiar with that, how would you best describe that?
Well, yeah, setting is so important in thrillers. I mean, it really enriches the drama of what's going on. So you're always looking to have the location of a chapter reinforce what's going on inside that chapter. And so I want readers to be able to feel as if they've been dropped down into the middle of every chapter and they can hear it and touch it and feel it and sense it happening all around them like they're invisible observers. And so that's an important part of creating the book. So for a lot of years, what I would do is typically I'd be visiting all the locations in person being there allows you to really feel what it's like to be in that area. And it's not just a question of physical senses. It's also a question of, I call it the six senses of place, because there's this additional layer of what emotions does a location evoke and how do you feel when you are in there? What's going through your head? If you can capture that, then I think it's going to really come alive for the reader. But it's been trickier the last few years because, of course, thanks to COVID, a lot of us have not exactly been able to do on-site research in the same way that we'd like to. So I've been able to sort of figure out alternate ways of researching locations. And it helps, having done this for enough years that feels okay. I'd still love to be, walking down the street of every, location that's occurring in a Bourne book or one of my other books. But, it's now at a point where in the world that just hasn't proven practical. So,
You brought up a really good point. I've never thought about it this way, but it is that sixth evident sense that is that feeling that almost this intuitive feeling like, whether it's I've been here before or this area makes me feel like this. And that's something, you can do Google flyovers and research your ears off, but if you don't really exist inside of it,
right,
it's that extra little bit that brings it alive.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah.
Now, I've enjoyed watching the evolution of your book covers. Back to my book cover gaping. There's a great evolution. And as I got to the end, I'm like, okay, Brian, oh yeah, Season of Fear, oh yeah, Turned to Stone, oh yeah. And then I get all the way to the end and I'm like, The Agency by Ali O'Brien. Wait, is that a misprint? Well, what is that?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Years ago, this is going back, I think, to 2009, I actually my agent at that time was based in London, and she'd always wanted to write a book set in the wild and woolly London publishing industry, but she wasn't a writer, so she came to me and said, hey, would you ever consider teaming up on a book? And I'm always looking for a creative challenge. I thought it sounded like fun, so I came up with the plot and wrote the book, and she offered her feedback, and we used a combination of our two names for the author. So she was Allie, and I was Brian. So Ali O'Brien became the author, and we got a great response. It was reviewed, got a great review in People magazine, and had a lot of fun with it. It was practically, what they call chick lit. I mean, it was more of a funny, romance. I actually wrote a second book, kind of a sequel to it, called West 57, which you can actually find out online under the name BN Freeman. It was hard because not long after The Agency came out, my lovely agent Allie passed away very suddenly and unexpectedly. So I wasn't even sure I wanted to do another book because the agency was so wrapped up in my relationship with Allie. But I felt like West 57 was already in my head, and it was sort of a tribute to Allie to write the follow up book as well. So that was how I dipped my toe in that side of the business. So
Sex and the City meets The Devil Wears Prada.
Pretty much. Exactly right. That's exactly right.
I love it. Well, and that was going to be my next question, which is kind of how it teed it up, is like, if you were to ever stop and not do this very specific genre that you have nailed, do you have a secret ambition even to do something completely off the reservation under a pen name, etc.?
Yeah, you know, I mean, for me, I have been blessed to have an amazing, career in publishing over the last two decades. And at this point, I take on projects because they sound like fun. I mean, you know, the idea of taking over the Bourne series, I mean, that just sounded like a hell of a lot of fun. And it was. I mean, this has been some of the most entertaining writing that I have done, in my whole career. It's just a great, great honor. So for me going forward, I would love to be able to dip my toe into other genres as well. I could see myself, trying historical fiction. I wouldn't mind writing nonfiction. I could see hooking up with someone to help them write their memoir or autobiography. There's all sorts of different things I'd like to try. I just love telling stories. That's what I'm in it for. And so being able to explore other aspects of that, and to me, that sounds great.
Yeah. Well, I love that. Before we get to our infamous rapid fire questions, I have a question that I always like to ask all my authors, visiting authors, is this. If you were to offer a single piece of advice for either an up and coming writer or someone who's considering it perhaps as a profession, what would that piece of advice be? And it doesn't have to be just one thing, but kind of that catch all.
Well, the first thing I always tell aspiring writers, and it sounds obvious, but 100% of unwritten books have never been published. it seems like an obvious thing. And yet, as I said earlier, I think for so many writers, whether it's established writers or aspiring writers, we're our own worst enemy. And I can't tell you how many aspiring writers I've talked to and heard from who will get, 50 pages of a book done, and then just walk away from it. They'll feel like, it's just no good. It's not going where I want it to go. And again, it's that voice in your head that just keeps telling you, I can't do this. And that's the voice that you've got to silence. And you've got to figure out that, ultimately at some point there's going to be a relationship between, the keyboard and your backside and some super glue, because you're going to have to just sit down and keep writing. And I tell folks, look, don't question yourself as you start writing. Don't constantly reread and edit those opening pages. Keep going. Keep telling the story, because when you get to the end of the story, odds are you're going to go back and realize, hey, those pages that I thought those were no good, actually, yeah, that kind of works for me. So that's what it's all about. You got to believe in yourself, and you got to keep going and get that first book done.
It is funny though, isn't it? It's the monkey mind. It's the guy on the shoulder that's doing the judgment that really it's not based in reality. That's one thing I have to always tell myself. That's just an emotional hit. You're feeling weak or insecure. That's all that is. It's because you've put the time in, you've put the words down. Take a breath, walk away, right? Come back.
Yeah. And I don't care whether you're working on your first novel or you're working on your 25th. I'll tell you, it never goes away. I mean, it's still a part of the way the writer's brain is wired. And I have as much, nerve-wracking, doubts and challenges, 20 years into this business that I had when I was getting started. I think that's part of the creative experience. And you have to sort of learn that, to use that to your advantage and realize that, that self-doubt is actually going to end up making a better book because you're just going to, demand, higher standards from yourself.
It makes me think of that phrase when they say, when people go, oh, do you ever get writer's block? And I'm like, you might hit a bump, but how about getting up from the desk and walking away and walking the dog or having a lunch and coming back? Because cops don't get cops block, or, firemen don't get fireman's block. I mean,
yeah, writer's block kind of gets in the way of my eating, If I don't publish a book, you know, well, I'm not making any money. So yeah, it is, you can't let that kind of stuff stop you. And, you know, I've learned that I don't call it writer's block. I have what I call tough chapter days, where you're just working on a chapter and, you know, it's just not coming together the way you want it to. And, you know, your immediate reaction is, well, that, we've had a good run. That's it. Never going to be able to write again. You know, and the next day you go back to it and you're like, oh, okay, here's what you do. And it all comes together.
So. Yeah. I love that. All right. How about a little rapid fire questions? Really easy. When writing, Brian, do you prefer a loud, hyperactive, caffeine riddled coffee shop or perhaps someplace quiet like a library or a home office?
You know, actually both. I switch it up quite a lot. And sometimes I'll write in the quiet of my office. Sometimes I'll write outside. Sometimes I'll pick up my laptop and go to a coffee shop. And sometimes if I'm writing a scene where there's music involved, I'll actually have my headphones on and I'll be playing the music that's in the scene as I'm writing that chapter. So.
Oh, I love that. Okay. Number two, as for discipline, do you prefer banging out an exhaustive outline before you sit down to craft the masterpiece, or do you have a basic idea and just wing it?
It's kind of in the middle. I do an outline, but it's much less intense than it used to be in my early books. I see it now as sort of more of a roadmap of, you know, here's where I'm starting, here's where I'm going, and there's some kind of mileage posts along the way. But I don't like to sort of lock myself into a structure, because even though I know who's doing what to whom and why, I like to be able to massage the suspense and the story as I'm going.
It's so amazing how many conversations with, I mean, we're now, you'll be our 76th, I suppose, or 77th episode, and how many conversations I've had about this very topic, and they generally are polar opposites. Oh no, I write by the seat of my pants. Oh no, I outline the bejesus out of it. And very few people, I would say you're probably right there in the middle. So you have a good structure, but you don't get tied to it because, and I think this is part of the magic of being a great organic storyteller, is I bet you, Brian, you are still surprised by some of the things that are happening, right?
Sure. Absolutely. Yeah. And you know, you learn to be able to sense where the drama is as you're going, and you know when you need to change things around. And things that seem like they're going to work when you're doing an outline, when you actually get into the reality of it, it's like, nope, we got to go a different way here. So
I was, my very first couple of books, I winged it, just pure winged it. And then along the way, I thought, well, you know, I hear about this outlining. And I did an exhaustive outline, like all the way to the, and then I started writing it. And I personally found myself getting a little bored only because I felt like I had already discovered everything and now I was just filling in the blank. That's neither here nor there, or good or bad. It's just, you know, particularly.
No, I think that's a reasonable risk that, you're writing. You don't want your writing style to feel flat if you're just sort of, you know, kind of putting an outline of words on the page. I mean, I think you want that spontaneity that comes with, you know, crafting things as you go. But, you know, it's different for every writer.
Exactly. All right. Number three, you and your wife have decided to ditch the cold of Minnesota for a month and just disappear to a nice exotic tropical island somewhere. Let's pretend you would love that. What two or three books would you be taking with you? You might be there a while.
You know, I would, if I were, you know, I assume we're saying books that I did not write.
Yeah.
It's always fun rereading mine too. I would probably take, Nelson DeMille's The Charm School. I think one of the great thrillers of all time. I'd take, In a Dry Season by Peter Robinson, just a magnificent, police procedural that goes back, cuts back and forth between the present and World War II. And I think I would also take Michael Connelly's Bloodwork, which, you know, I mean, I love the Bosch novels, but Bloodwork is still, I think, my favorite of everything he's done, because the solution to what's going on is just so elegantly simple, and yet you never see it coming. And that's what I always look for in a great thriller, is that the solution to the mystery should ultimately have been staring you in the face the whole time, and you just never saw it there.
That is so hard to, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
Oh man. All right. Fourth and final, Hollywood producers have come calling, bought the rights to Bourne Sacrifice, and want you to choose a new Jason Bourne. So, who would you pick and why?
Oh boy, that's a tough one. yeah, I'm not going down that rabbit hole. I'd like to take Matt Damon and peel a few years off him and put him back in there. But and you know, who knows? I mean, heck, you know, Liam Neeson is still doing thrillers, and he must be what, 85 by now. So there's no reason Matt couldn't take over for one more.
Yeah. Side note about Liam, he's now doing kind of the same movie over and over again.
Yes.
And back to Matt, though, I Brian, I got to tell you something. I went drilling down this morning to find out if Matt's going to come back. And I'm like, to me personally, there is no other Jason but Matt, but that's just me. And have you heard one way or the other? Do you have any idea?
I have not heard anything. I know that I think it would take an amazing script to get, you know, Matt on board, because I saw interviews where he was not happy with, you know, the script for the last movie, Jason Bourne. So I mean, you know, my attitude is, well, I think he ought to be reading some of the other books that are out there. The timing to me would be so perfect. I mean, now it's been quite a few years since we've had a Jason Bourne novel. I think, you know, given Hollywood looking to rebound after the pandemic, getting Jason Bourne back in theaters would be a tremendous move. So I really hope they're working on it.
Yeah, I can't say that his last one was my favorite.
No, I wasn't terribly crazy about that one. I thought, you know, the first three, the ones that, you know, had the Ludlum titles, I thought all three of those were excellent. So.
Yeah, yeah. Well, from your lips to God's ears.
Let's cross our fingers. Exactly. Yeah.
All right. Well, folks, to learn more, visit bfreemanbooks.com and follow him on both Twitter and Instagram at the same bfreemanbooks. Brian, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much. It was my pleasure.
And I hope, you know, I hope we can come back around, maybe chat about I Remember You, hint, hint.
Yep. Happy to do it. Actually, if you want to chat a little bit later this year, I'll have both I Remember You out and the next Jonathan Stride novel, The Zero Night, will be out as well. So we can compare notes. So.
Wait a minute. It's July. You're talking about getting two more out by Christmas?
Well, they're all done, fortunately. So, this has been quite the year. I mean, actually, four book launches this year. The Ursulina came out in print and E on February 1st, and now The Bourne Sacrifice, I Remember You, and The Zero Night all coming out in the space of about 3 months. So,
and one thing I just popped back into my mind, and I want to bring this up. So you said you're working with Blackstone Publishing.
Yeah.
Blackstone Publishing is now one of my favorite new companies. I've been watching them for a while, but I got introduced more deeply by way of Andrews Wilson and then by Rick Blywise, who wrote a book called Pinyon Scorpion.
Yep.
But here's the thing I love. Their attention to detail and quality on both the jackets and the creation of the book. You may think, oh, it's just a book. No. Peel it away and look at some of what's going on underneath, like Hotel California, for instance.
Yes. Yep.
Holy moly. They've taken quality to a whole new level.
Yeah, they put out a great product, and it's been really exciting to see them, you know, evolve over the last few years, because Blackstone started out exclusively as an audio publisher. In fact, they've been my audio publisher since the beginning with Immoral. They were my publisher all the way back then. And since they see them moving now and having taken over, ebook and print books as well, that's been a really exciting transition. And they've brought some great authors into their catalog. They're terrific to work with.
Yeah, that's what I hear. Just nice, nice things. Well, folks, once again, the book is, and you're going to want to add this to your summertime reading. I promise you, it is, it's on my top 10. But again, Brian, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
The book is The Bourne Sacrifice, Robert Ludlum's Legacy Continues, and is in good hands with Brian. Folks, before I go, I want to remind you of just two simple things. Number one, love your emails. Please feel free to email us at any time. thethrillerzone@gmail.com. That's it. You got a complaint? You got a request? You want to hear about our swag? They're getting ready to open a store soon. You tell me about it. I'll get back to you. I promise. And number two, please do us a favor and subscribe to our YouTube channel, youtube.com/thethrillerzone. It helps build an audience. You can also click that little bell and it'll ring, not literally, but it will let you know when new episodes drop. So we love your subscriptions to the show. I can't wait to tell you who's on the next show, but there's a couple of people vying for that position and it hasn't been confirmed just yet. So I'm going to leave you in a little bit of suspense and simply say, we'll see you next time for another edition of The Thriller Zone.